We're going to begin with a prayer of John Henry Cardinal Newman's. Newman, the great 19th century apologist. Let us pray. All bountiful Creator, who when Thou didst mold the world, didst drain the waters from the mass, so that earth might immovable remain, that its dull clods it might transmute to golden flowers in vale or wood, to juice of thirst allaying fruit, and grateful herbage spread for food, wash Thou our smarting wounds and hot, in the cool freshness of Thy grace, till tears start forth the past to blot, and cleanse and calm Thy holy place, till we obey Thy full behest, shun the world's tainted touch and breath, joy in what highest is and best, and gain a spell to baffle death. Grant it, O Father, only Son, and Holy Spirit, God of grace, to whom all glory, three in one, be given in every time and place. Amen. All right, let's say just a few more words about C.S. Lewis before we go into our material for tonight. What C.S. Lewis does in what we call the objective area, in the area of direct apologetic argument, is not especially original. What he does in miracles, what he does in mere Christianity, and so forth, is not particularly original. You will find the same kinds of argumentation used by other people, and he is operating out of what is usually considered the conservative Anglican Neo-Thomist tradition. Now, this has to be clarified. Notice Anglican Neo-Thomist tradition, not just Neo-Thomist. Geisler is a Neo-Thomist in the sense of having that same fascination for scholastic argument that the Thomists have always had. The Anglican Neo-Thomist tradition doesn't have any interest in philosophical scholastic argumentation. You don't find in Lewis at all the categories of traditional scholasticism, arguments about essence and substance and all that sort of thing. The English are a very, very practical people, a very pragmatic people, and they are not interested in the theoretical side of discussions such as this. They're much more interested in a common sense approach. So Lewis comes out of that sort of tradition, and the Neo-Thomist side of it is that he argues in terms of natural theology. He argues from nature to God, as in mere Christianity. He argues from commonly agreed upon ethical principles to God, as he does in the little book, The Abolition of Man. He argues from nature to the divine by way of miracles, very much in the same way as Bishop Butler did, or Paley in the 18th century. This is Neo-Thomist only in the sense that it has an interest in natural theology and argues from there. It doesn't restrict itself, in other words, to the specific details of special revelation. The work that Lewis does in the quote-unquote objective area is striking not for its originality, but for its lucidity, for its clarity. Probably nobody else has ever expressed that type of argument in such a clear and effective way in the English language. Even Paley, who had a marvelous writing style, didn't manage it as succinctly and perceptively as Lewis. You should realize that those objective apologetic writings of Lewis, the miracles, mere Christianity, problem of pain, and so forth, are now available in a single paperback volume, all of them together, five of them together, and the cost is fairly low, maybe $3.95 or something like that. $6.95.
There's another edition that's $3.95.
With the same stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that should be easy to make a choice on. Yeah. Okay. That's like the difference between a 5-cent ice cream cone and a 10-cent ice cream cone. The difference is 5 cents. You see, same sort of thing. You should certainly pick up copies of that collection of Lewis in paperback. You should get a dozen of those and have them ready for constant circulation among the non-Christians you witness to who have apologetic problems, because really you won't find as lucid presentations of classic arguments as you get them there. The area where Lewis is original is in the subjective side of his apologetic, the literary side. There are very few people in the history of apologetics who have used literature effectively in conveying Christian truth. We mentioned Raymond Lull, who did a novel, Blancherna, that was an apologetic novel in the Middle Ages. In some sense, a work like Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress can be regarded as a literary apologetic, because it does take up certain kinds of objections to the Christian faith and handles these on a level that strikes deeper than the solely rational level. At the same time, you don't see very much of this. Blancherna is hardly read any longer. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is much more concerned with theological questions inside the church, surely, than it is with apologetic questions coming in from outside the church. Lewis, however, together with Charles Williams, the Oxford editor, and J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, has employed literary imagery in an amazing fashion. Now, what makes this so original? These writers have seen that there is a common fund of images in human beings. Human beings have an essentially similar psychic life at the root level. As you begin moving toward the unconscious, as you begin moving from conscious to unconscious, the psychic life of people becomes more similar. And this psychic life expresses certain fundamental and basic needs. Carl Gustav Jung, the student of Freud, who broke with Freud, placed a great deal of stress on this. He studied what he called the archetypes of the collective unconscious, fundamental images that are basic to people in all walks of life and in all cultures. This kind of imagery displays itself symbolically, and the symbols are very much common to people throughout the world because the fundamental needs are common. The fairy tales of the world are the common heritage bubbling up from these basic needs and expressing themselves in these images. Thus, in the fairy tale, the concept of the princess who is in a difficulty of some sort that she cannot get out of. Often she is cursed, and a witch has rendered her incapable of operating as she should. And the prince who comes often by prophecy, and he is able by love, by the kiss of love, to raise her up from a trance-like state. The king, the father figure, and the old witch representing evil. These figures keep occurring and recurring in the literature of the world. Now, Lewis and Tolkien particularly, and in another way, Charles Williams, have consciously developed literary products that use these images. because they recognize that these images trigger fundamental expressions of need. They can get past the conscious monitor and hit people at a level that they don't want to have operate. And if you stay solely on the conscious rational level, people will often refuse to allow you to get at them. But these stories that employ fundamental archetypes strike down to levels of depth that conscious argument often is not able to. Thus, Lewis's Narnian Chronicles are, in a very genuine sense, an evangelism in depth. And why has Tolkien's Lord of the Rings grabbed people so that they simply cannot get loose from it? Why have posters appeared on college campuses saying, "Come to Middle Earth"? Why do people prefer the company of Gandalf and of Frodo rather than the company of their contemporaries? Because actually they are operating there on a level of fundamental need. Somehow this is striking them at a point where the more conscious rational operations are not able to. But you see, at this fundamental point in people's psychic life, the need is for restoration, for a healing of opposites, for the conjunctio oppositorum in the expression of Jung and Mircea Eliade, the conjunction of opposites, the healing of the fragmented soul. And such a healing of fragmentation is only going to take place when there is a redemptive act performed. Thus, the whole theme of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is the theme of redemption. Finally, Frodo is willing to throw himself, if need be, into the volcano to destroy the ring that is binding the souls of Middle-earth. And this kind of thing opens people up to the answers that the gospel story presents. This is why Lewis can say, and Tolkien says in his essay on fairy stories, that in a very real sense, the fairy stories of the world point to the gospel story, and the gospel story fulfills all of their longings. Now, that kind of an apologetic is most remarkable because, you see, it gets beyond the purely untestable subjective, the untestable aspect of subjectivity, and arrives at a point where you're striking subjectively, but there is an objective validity to this, because people in general have these same needs. It isn't the same thing as one Christian going to a non-Christian and saying, listen to my testimony. And then the Christian presents his exciting drug career and laminates the gospel onto the end of this. It isn't that sort of thing. That's no proof of anything, because all that says is that this particular individual has had that kind of an experience. But when you work with these fundamental archetypes, as Lewis and Tolkien and Williams are doing, you're working with imagery that can objectively be shown to characterize man's psychic life. And if this sort of thing touches people on that level, it's very difficult to say that all this is a Fig Newton of somebody's individual subjectivity. It isn't that sort of thing at all. It has a far more universal cast to it. So it seems to me that this is a remarkable kind of area in contemporary apologetics, and it provides a good transition into areas that I think have the greatest potential for new apologetic breakthroughs. Seems to me that if I were to characterize the areas of potential apologetic breakthrough, I would begin with the school of apologetic literature that Lewis, Tolkien, and Charles Williams represents. This is something that you can't find in the earlier history of apologetics to any extent. It's arisen in part because of the psychoanalytic studies of the early 20th century, but it incorporates the best of traditional Christian insights as well. And just parenthetically, Don't ever get the idea that a secular movement is 100% demonic and has no possibility. The Lord didn't stop using non-Christians when Nebuchadnezzar died. The Lord brings good out of ill all over the place. And so instead of panicking in the face of unbelief, and instead of running in the opposite direction, feeling that the dibbles are after you, I think it's a much better idea to stop stark still and recognize that this is still God's world and the cross is still able to conquer these areas, and start looking for ways in which these areas can be brought in as positive means of presenting the gospel. It's been one of the characteristics of fundamentalism that it's gone running with a scared shriek every time any unbelief has turned up anywhere, instead of conquering these areas for Christ. It doesn't say a great deal for a person's commitment to the absolute authority of the Bible if he doesn't feel that the Bible is able to deal with these problems. If all you can do is to run into your chicken coop with your Bible and slam and lock the door, in the Bible Belt somewhere, I don't think that says a great deal about the scripture that you claim is the answer to everything. All right. What are some... incidentally, I should say that another writer in that same general neck of the woods, although not doing exactly the same sort of thing, is Dorothy Sayers. Dorothy Sayers, the author of the Lord Peter Wimsey stories. There's some stuff on Dorothy Sayers in the most recent issue of Christianity Today. I'll be referring to that issue a little bit later. Dorothy Sayers, in spite of the fact that she also was a very strange gal in lots of respects, used literature and literary categories to present the gospel. Even in the Lord Peter Wimsey stories, you get a little bit of that. Those of you who have read The Nine Tailors, for example, or who saw the marvelous BBC TV production of The Nine Tailors in a series last year, recognize how that kind of thing operates. Dorothy Sayers also did some straight Christian apologetics. The book entitled The Mind of the Maker is a masterpiece. The Mind of the Maker is an effort to argue for the rationality of divine creation by analogy with human literary creativity. Dorothy Sayers says, let's see how writers create. And then she builds by analogy to divine creativity. This is in the tradition, of course, of Bishop Butler. This is Butler's analogy. See what's going on here in this world, and you'll get a good insight into what's going on in the next. Take natural revelation, and it will accord with special revelation. Dorothy Sayers, as an Englishwoman, is again operating out of that same sort of Anglican or English Neo-Thomist tradition that we've associated with Lewis. So you ought to keep her in mind, too. Also, she's done a marvelous little book entitled Creed or Chaos. Creed or Chaos. Other works of hers along that line are most effective. Yeah? George MacDonald is the 19th century granddaddy of this sort of thing. It was from George MacDonald that Lewis got his ideas to do his children's stories. George MacDonald was an Anglican preacher who wasn't very well known in the 19th century, but he did children's stories such as The Princess and the Gurdie, this sort of thing. You people certainly didn't have any of those read to you, but if you were of my generation, you would have gotten in just on the tail end of that sort of thing. They were still being read a little bit. They are back in print. It would be difficult for you to appreciate these because they're very 19th century-ish. The girls all go around in gossamer gowns, the atmosphere is just very, very 19th century. And there's a certain amount of 19th century English moralism in them. But this is the beginning of that kind of thing. Also, George MacDonald did some supernatural novels for adults, Lilith and Phantastes, and these are the basis of Charles Williams' much more difficult works, more difficult even than Lewis's and Tolkien's, presenting Christianity through the medium of fantasy and supernatural fiction. Works of Charles Williams like the Greater Trumps and so forth. Anyway, this is an area that if you have any literary sensitivity at all, you would find most interesting. And it seems to me this has immense possibilities apologetically. It combines, in some sense, the objective check, which is always necessary in apologetics to prevent apologetics from just degenerating into personal testimony, and the depth dimension of a subjective or existential impact. All right, what other areas have breakthrough possibilities? The two areas that I'm going to discuss with you tonight are areas where there hasn't really been a direct application of the areas to apologetics yet. But the application is on its way. There are signs of it. And I think that a great deal can be done at these points. And in the case of the second of these two areas, I think that it has the potential of getting by an impasse that has existed in apologetics ever since the beginning of the modern secular era. I'm not going to be able to give you specific examples in most instances of works by Christians using these areas, but I'm going to outline what the possibilities are. I'm going to give you some references, and as you might suggest, most of these references turn out to be stuff that I've done recently or am in process of doing, because it seems to me that these areas have the greatest potential. All right, the first of them has to do with the application of analytical philosophy to the defense of the faith. The application of analytical philosophy to the defense of the faith. Along the way in the course, I have alluded to this area called analytical philosophy. I have, for example, made the distinction between analytic statements and synthetic statements. I placed quite a little emphasis on this at a couple of points. I pointed out that you cannot expect 100% proof of any matter of fact. The only items that can be proven 100% are definitional matters in the realm of deductive logic or pure mathematics. The minute that you move out of these definitional areas into the realm of fact, you have to collect evidence in order to provide the kind of verification that's necessary. So you already have a little insight into what analytical philosophy has been doing, though I didn't tie this to a particular movement. And so I want to tell you a little bit about this movement and then make as plain as I can what it seems to me the possibilities are of it. Most people, when they think of philosophy, think of traditional philosophy, which tries to explain the world. Look at the use of the term philosophy in ordinary parlance. We talk about somebody's philosophy of life. What's your philosophy? Meaning, how do you look at the world? And so, when we think of philosophy through the centuries, we think of various people, generally bald-headed and fat, sitting, contemplating the universe and arriving at certain vast metaphysical explanations of it, or soi-disant explanations, so-called apparent explanations that really turn out not to have that quality. You know the old line about scientists who learn more and more about less and less until they know everything, everything about nothing, as compared with philosophers who learn less and less about more and more until they know nothing about everything. That is the popular conception of the philosopher. A person who is not much concerned with particular data and who tries to get vast cosmic interpretations of things. And these vast cosmic interpretations generally end up as utterly unverifiable, uncheckable expressions of the man's own way of looking at the world. They generally arrive at autobiography. Autobiography is projected on the screen of the cosmos, and it's supposed to be an explanation of the world, but it doesn't have any significant difference from that of anybody else. You can't verify any of them. They contradict each other, but where are you? All right. That isn't what philosophers have always been doing, but enough of them have been doing this to warrant that picture, at least to a certain extent. As one wag has said, philosophers may not know the solutions, but they certainly know the problems. They have been able to see cosmic problems, and they have offered vast solutions, in quotes, which turn out not to be worth much of anything. The 19th century was particularly rife with that kind of philosophizing because of Hegel. Remember Kierkegaard's criticism of Hegel. And following Hegel came the Neo-Hegelians, who modified Hegel, tried to do him one better. And by the time of the First World War, roughly, these systems all lay there, and no one was able to exclude the others, and the whole thing was a pretty sad business. In the years from about the turn of the century to the First World War, a new movement was beginning in philosophy. And this is the movement that's come to be known as analytical philosophy. And it appeared largely as a reaction to that kind of thing. This movement is a critical movement in the history of philosophy. It does not attempt to provide cosmic explanations. Instead, it deals very keenly and simply with the question, how do you verify? How do you verify? How do you determine whether statements are worth making or not? It pretty well restricts philosophy to the branch of it called epistemology. It deals with the question of truth. How do you determine whether something is true or not? And it aimed its big guns on traditional philosophy. Because the analytical philosophers concluded that the 19th century members of their profession really weren't able to verify what they were saying. The movement began in a very esoteric fashion. It began by the work of certain people in the philosophy of mathematics. These people tried to find out how you verify mathematical statements. And in beginning with that issue, they gradually got to the question of the foundation of mathematics, the nature of mathematics. Out of this came the great work by Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead. Russell and Whitehead's work, the Principia Mathematica. It has a Latin title. It means, of course, the principles of mathematics, mathematical principles. Principia Mathematica. When this work was first published, it was said that there were only a dozen people in the world who could understand it. The work is 99.44% in symbolic language. It's in the language of the modern existential calculus, which is a development of classical logic. It's an extremely difficult work. My professor at Cornell, Max Black, was supposed to have been one of the people who could understand it, and there were scuttlebutt stories at Cornell that he had actually found an error in it somewhere, you see. And of course that put him on the sort of plane where no one dared touch him without first removing their shoes. But the point of the Principia Mathematica was to show that all of mathematics is a special case of deductive logic. Mathematics is doing what logic is doing, and all of logic stems from certain primary axioms, and indeed a very small number of them. The one essential axiom that you've got to have to deduce this whole business is the law of non-contradiction. The law of non-contradiction, that something cannot be its opposite at the same time under the same conditions. A is not non-A. A is not non-A. That is the fundamental expression which, along with certain other expressions that are variable, can allow for the complete system of deductive logic and, finally, the system of mathematics. All right. So how do you verify mathematical statements or logical statements? You relate them back through the system to the axioms. That's how you do it. It's not a system that deals with the nature of the world. It's a system that has to do with relationships. It's a system that exists by definition. It's not a system that you would ever be able to verify by checking of particular statements. This precipitated people into an analysis of how you verify other statements. What about other statements that are not mathematical statements or logical statements? And here we meet the most fascinating figure in 20th century philosophy, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein, W-I-T-T-G-E-N-S-T-E-I-N, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Those of you who are in music or who've had any background in the history of music are aware of another Wittgenstein, a one-armed pianist whose arm was shot off in the First World War, and a number of compositions were written for him, and that's a very important aspect of contemporary piano music. He was a brother of Ludwig Wittgenstein. It was an Austrian family, a brilliant Austrian family, and Ludwig Wittgenstein did a work entitled, and this also has a Latin title, though it was written in German, Tractatus Logico, L-O-G-I-C-O, hyphen, Philosophicus. It means logical, philosophical tractate. Tractatus Logico Philosophicus. Like philosophy with an I-C-U-S on it. This work is entirely in numbered propositions that run from 1.0 all the way to 7.0, and these propositions develop an understanding of verification, which is vital to analytical philosophy into 20th century thinking. Wittgenstein was a self-taught individual, very largely, a very strange person in many ways, not a social gentleman at all. He did most of the work on this in the trenches during the First World War, and it was published in German in a German philosophical journal. It came to the attention of Bertrand Russell, and Wittgenstein wanted to teach, but you couldn't teach without an appropriate English university degree in England. And Wittgenstein had only a degree or certificate in engineering. And so this problem was solved very simply. Russell and G.E. Moore, the great ethicist, put up Wittgenstein for a doctor's degree in philosophy. And at the Oxbridge universities, this doesn't involve any coursework. It's a matter of doing a dissertation. And so they use the Tractatus as the dissertation. And one afternoon, Wittgenstein and Moore and Russell spent 3 hours discussing philosophy and drinking. And that was the oral examination. And Wittgenstein received his degree of Doctor of Philosophy. And from that point on, it was possible for him to teach in the British university system. He did very little teaching. He was actually a lousy teacher in lots of respects, but his work had a tremendously influential effect on students in the generation just before the Second World War and in the years of the war. Wittgenstein died of cancer at a fairly early age, and his work was published, most of it posthumously. During his lifetime, only the Tractatus was published and one journal article, and that was all. The other stuff circulated in manuscript and has gradually been published since. Now, Wittgenstein argued that where matters of fact are concerned, the only way to demonstrate assertions is by the collection of facts. And therefore, you've got to distinguish between analytic statements, though he didn't use these terms, analytic statements for the mathematical logical type and synthetic statements dealing with matters of fact. Other statements would turn out to be in principle unverifiable. In principle unverifiable. And that's exactly where these grandiose views of the world that had been presented in the 19th century fell. At the end of Wittgenstein's Tractatus, he makes statements such as this. He says, a true book of ethics, or true ethical assertions, could only exist outside of the world. They can't exist in the world. Ethics is transcendental, said Wittgenstein. What did he mean by this? He meant that if you are a person in this world, you never have enough perspective to be able to make aught statements that are universal in significance, because your statements of ethics are just going to rise from your own situation. And under those circumstances, if you generalize these and you say they're applicable to everybody, that's gratuitous. The same goes for metaphysical statements about the nature of the universe. You don't know enough about the universe for that. You can't possibly step outside of it and see it in perspective. Under those circumstances, you can't expect these statements to have any verification. The Tractatus ends with the notion that philosophy is really a kind of ladder that takes you up, and finally, you throw the ladder away, and you apparently move into the realm of the mystical or the unverifiable if you try to attain knowledge of vast questions such as metaphysical or ethical questions. Wittgenstein himself was well aware of the fact that the only thing that could even in principle solve this problem of knowing what the world was in the large would be some kind of revelation. Norman Malcolm, my teacher of philosophy at Cornell, was a close friend of Wittgenstein, and Wittgenstein spent time at his home during the last year of Wittgenstein's life. Norman Malcolm has done a memoir of Wittgenstein, which is entirely non-technical and a fascinating little book to read. It's only about 90 pages long. It's called Ludwig Wittgenstein, a Memoir. In that, he recounts how Wittgenstein often would walk along and say, "Oh my God," as if, says Malcolm, imploring a divine intervention. Because Wittgenstein recognized that without a divine intervention, without somebody coming from the outside who knew what the whole business meant, you could never discover it yourself. Because you're limited either to definitional statements or to particular statements that can be verified by particular facts. But you can never put all of these together to get a cosmic understanding. Wittgenstein died without any recognition of such a revelation. Apparently, the only contact that he ever had with Orthodox Christians was a few contacts with a very traditionalistic Jesuit, and the Jesuit gave him the theistic proofs for the existence of God and that kind of thing, and Wittgenstein found that pretty puerile and didn't pay much attention to it, and that was about it. Posthumously, his lectures on aesthetics and religious belief were published. These were not actual lectures that were delivered, but they give his thoughts on the subject, and it's clear that he was groping for something, but he didn't see the actual possibility of this. He probably would have said something like this, that the minute a revelation from outside, the minute that a God were to enter this world, that God would immediately be subject to the problems of this world, and so you wouldn't end up with any answers there either. In any case, he is something like Socrates or Plato. I've quoted in my Shape of the Past a passage from Plato's Phaedo, in which Plato says, I've done the best I can in my philosophizing. If only I had a raft of revelation to carry me over the seas of doubt. Now, the closest thing to that that you can find in modern philosophy is Wittgenstein, who is saying, apparently, the only choice is between kidding yourself into thinking you can understand the universe without revelation, or dying in despair, but at least honestly recognizing that you can't create a view of the world yourself that's worth anything. And says Wittgenstein, I'd rather do the second than the first. Well, out of the work of Wittgenstein, his early stage, and I haven't talked about the later stage of his philosophizing yet, but out of this early stage came a movement called the Vienna Circle. The Vienna Circle, or logical positivism. This is so named because most of the representatives of it were in Vienna, but they were not dancing to Strauss waltzes or that sort of thing. They were engaged in a very, very strict philosophical activity, more along the lines of mathematical logic than anything else. These people developed a hard-nosed, quote-unquote, a hard-nosed interpretation of what Wittgenstein was saying, and that particular viewpoint has come into English principally through the writings of A.J. Ayer, A-Y-E-R, an English philosopher who is still living and who has popularized the philosophy of the Vienna Circle. He isn't necessarily the most astute representative of it, but he certainly is the most vocal and has presented this kind of viewpoint. And he gave the expression logical positivism to the English language through his book of that title. All right, what did he say? Said he, it's perfectly simple. We can't make any meaningful statements about anything that isn't scientifically testable. Now, that is not exactly what Wittgenstein was saying. Wittgenstein was not limiting testability to scientific testability, though he was insisting that any factual testability had to involve factual investigation. Now, there's a distinction there. Wittgenstein was not saying that you've got to boil it over a low flame in order to test it. Okay? But very largely, that's what Ayer was saying, or it boiled down to that. So, in the first edition of Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic, Ayer says that all ethical statements are meaningless, all religious statements are meaningless, and all aesthetic statements are meaningless. You can't say anything artistically or religiously or ethically that is actually provable, because these statements are outside of the realm of any kind of laboratory investigation. Indeed, historical statements aren't worth anything. Ayer even goes to that point. So, because obviously you can't dig up Napoleon and boil him over a low flame, can you? This produced a very hard-nosed and rigid kind of application of Wittgenstein. And these people talk about a verification principle. And by a verification principle, they mean very largely this kind of scientific, repeatable laboratory testability for things. There is some softening of this viewpoint later. The verification principle goes through a number of softenings, but it's, in general, that kind of approach. These people are reductionists. They want to reduce the area of significant statements as much as possible. Of course, Wittgenstein himself wanted to reduce the area of significant statements so as to get rid of metaphysical balderdash but he was more concerned with getting rid of philosophical nonsense in the widest sense than he was reducing the number of areas of significant discourse. All right. Wittgenstein went through a transition in his philosophizing. Once he had finished the Tractatus, he concluded that he had solved all that you could solve philosophically. He had shown the limits of meaningful philosophical language. It was his position that the limits of our language are the limits of our world. And he had shown the limits of the language, and so he had shown the limits of any meaningful statement of what the world consisted of. So he stopped philosophizing. He went back to the continent and engaged in some architectural diddly-diddling. There are some houses that were designed by Wittgenstein that can still be seen on the continent, and just left philosophizing. But then he had a rather traumatic experience. He was on the train with another philosopher by the name of Sraffa, an Italian. And as in the case of most Italians, Sraffa was unable to speak without using his hands. In the case of an Italian, you know, if you tie his hands behind his back, he is rendered mute. Wittgenstein had argued that that the only significant statements were ones that had testability in the wider sense in which we've talked about it. So Sraffa made an obscene Neapolitan gesture, and he said, "What is the logical form of that?" And this sent Wittgenstein back into philosophizing. Because it was clear that this obscene Neapolitan gesture was doing something. It was doing something, even though the something was not able to be verified in the ordinary sense of verification. That is to say, language had a function other than that of verification, and Wittgenstein had neglected that area. So he went back into philosophizing to determine primarily what the language games are that people play. And the expression "language games" is the magic expression for understanding the work of the later Wittgenstein. He tries to analyze how language functions. And here he says, language has meaning according to its use. You find the meaning of language in its use. And he analyzed the various language games that people play. And these games include a number of areas which cannot be verified in an ordinary direct sense. For example, he gives the illustration of a census taker who goes around and he asks what work people do in a small town. In the course of doing this, he comes across somebody who doesn't do any work, and the person reports that he does no work. Now, says Wittgenstein, is this a meaningful statement? Very definitely, and it's a meaningful statistic, because knowing that the man doesn't do any work says something important about the psychology of that man and about the sociology of that community, even though it doesn't actually say anything about any work that is really going on. Wittgenstein is saying here that many kinds of linguistic statements don't do any work in the sense of establishing truth as to the world. They don't make any epistemological statements. They are not truth statements, but they are nonetheless meaningful because they are carrying on a different kind of activity within the framework of psychology, sociology, of human experience. The interpretation of Wittgenstein has generally set this second stage of his work over against the first, and has said Wittgenstein finally came to the conclusion that verification isn't important. Who cares about verification? The important thing, after all, is the way people use language. Well, that is appallingly superficial. Wittgenstein, in the posthumous work representing the second stage called the Philosophical Investigations, said, you must finally ask whether a given language game as a whole can be verified. Does the entire language game, the entire sphere, say anything as to truth? So it's perfectly plain that Wittgenstein never dumped the truth question. All he was doing is trying to analyze areas internally which he had neglected before. The truth question was still there and as significant to him at the end of his life as at the beginning. In fact, he said that he did not want to have the philosophical investigations published separately. He wanted them published as part two of the Tractatus, and that is frequently forgotten by the people who interpret him. Now, what is the significance of this business apologetically? The significance is not what some religious liberals have thought it was. They are the ones who have been just delighted with the later Wittgenstein's discussion of language games, because they say, you know, theology doesn't have to be verified. We don't have to worry about that. The important thing is how the language articulates. And all we have to do is to show the internal consistency of religious language. Religious language will make sense if we see its internal relationships. Not that at all. The emphasis of Wittgenstein on language is important. It's important particularly for anyone who holds to a verbal revelation, to a revelation in words and in language, as Orthodox Christians do. And you can gain a great deal from the study of students of Wittgenstein in that regard. For example, Ian Ramsey, the Christian theologian who worked very strongly with the philosophical investigations of Wittgenstein, did a work entitled Religious Language and a number of other things. This stuff is extremely important and extremely valuable. But the real value of Wittgenstein comes in his work on the Tractatus and his insistence on proper verification. And the best way to see this, I think, is in terms of the famous Flu Wisdom Parable, which I have used in a number of places in my writings, and you've already come across it in connection with readings for this course. The Flu Wisdom Parable is a parable presenting the situation in the world relative to the question of God's existence. Once upon a time, two explorers come upon a clearing in the jungle where are growing many flowers and many weeds. And the question is there a gardener who comes and tends this plot? This parable, developed by Anthony Flew and John Wisdom. John Wisdom is a student of the later Wittgenstein. Anthony Flew is the most penetrating atheistic critic of Christianity alive today. These two developed this parable having to do with the question of whether God really exists or not. The gardener represents God. Is there a gardener who comes and takes care of the world? The world has some order in it, certainly, but also has chaos in it. So, is there a gardener or not? Well, the two explorers set a watch. No gardener is seen. They remember H.G. Wells' Invisible Man, so they set up a barbed wire fence around the garden to see if an invisible intruder will come, and they patrol it with bloodhounds. But no intruder appears, apparently. There is no evidence of electric shock. The bloodhounds never give a cry. But at the end of all of this, the believer is still not convinced. He says there is a gardener, invisible, intangible, insensible to electric shocks. And he comes in secret to take care of the garden which he loves. To which the skeptic replies, but how does that kind of a gardener differ from an imaginary gardener or even from no gardener at all? You see, this parable presents the death by a thousand qualifications as far as religious statements are concerned. People who say there is a God, people who say there is religious truth, but they never offer any evidence for it. There's never any concrete evidence. The fact of the matter is that if you're going to make statements about the world, you're going to have to offer some evidence for them or they are meaningless. The best statement of the verification principle in the spirit of Wittgenstein, not in the spirit of A.J. Ayer, is something like this. That in order for a statement to be meaningful epistemologically, meaningful in the sense of saying anything true or potentially saying anything true, it's got to be in principle verifiable. In principle, it's got to be verifiable, or at least, at very minimum, in principle, it's got to be disconfirmable. Disconfirmable. There must be some way, at least in principle, of disproving it. If you're able, in principle, to state what would disprove such a position, then, in principle, the conditions for proving it are also set. But a statement made that cannot even in principle be disproved is a statement that is not carrying any epistemological freight. It isn't actually saying anything one way or the other. I have illustrated this in a number of essays, one favorite example of mine is the religious statement that there is a little green man, a little green god, this little green god loves us, he sits on a planet exactly 10 miles out of the range of the best telescope on Earth. And there he eats toasted cheese sandwiches. And he loves those who eat toasted cheese sandwiches. And he wants us to give toasted cheese to others. And so you can develop a whole ethic out of this. You can have a sacramental system easily with this, as you can imagine. All right. And as the telescopes get more powerful, he moves farther away. So he is always 10 miles beyond the range of the best telescope on Earth. Now, if you think about this a little bit, you will see that what apparently is a meaningful assertion, I mean, it has the same form as other assertions, such as there is a McDonald's stand on Tustin Avenue, is nonetheless not that kind of an assertion at all. It only has the trappings, the facade of a meaningful assertion, because I've set it up in such a way that in principle there is no way to disprove it or prove it. No evidence can count for it or against it. You see? Now what Flew and Wisdom are saying is that's the way the religious cookie crumbles right here on earth. That's just the kind of statements that people are making about religion, and they aren't worth anything. Now Wittgenstein would say they are worth something. Even statements like that are worth something. They tell you a lot about the psychology of the individual. They tell you a lot about the sociology of his group, maybe about his time, but they certainly aren't telling you anything about the world necessarily. But quite evidently, at this point, Christianity moves into the picture and Christianity is able to deal with this issue as no other religion is. Because Christianity doesn't make unverifiable statements about God. Take a squint at 1 Corinthians 15, everybody. There Paul presents the evidence for the resurrection of Christ, eyewitnesses. And he says, if Christ is not risen from the dead, we are of all men most miserable. We've been deceiving others. We've been deceiving ourselves. We are yet in our sins. He says, in effect, Christianity is disconfirmable in principle. If Christ didn't rise from the dead, Christianity is worthless. He's willing to stake the truth of Christianity on the facticity of the resurrection. Christianity is a historical religion in this special sense, that its truth depends upon certain historical facts. Now, I suggest that if you look to the other religions of the world, you'll find that they all, every one of them, falls under the axe of the flu wisdom parable and is actually in the same realm as those grandiose 19th century attempts to understand the universe that really are not worth anything because they can't be confirmed or disconfirmed. When our Buddhist friends talk about Brahma being all, what in the Sam Hill can you do with a statement like this? You can't. There are no conditions for confirming or disconfirming that. You finally end up with a feeling that this is just a name for everything. And if you want to attach this name to it, fine. If you don't, fine. The situation remains just about the same in either case. And so on and so on and so on down the line. This means that in a revolution in philosophy which has brought people back to the question of testability and to a clean distinction among statements as to how testability takes place, Christianity can move in here and say, we have a system which is based upon revelation and confirmable revelation such that we can make meaningful statements about the nature of the universe, and nobody else can. This puts Christians in a very different position from what they were in 100 years ago. 100 years ago, you had a situation where everybody was sort of setting up his cosmic philosophy, and about all you could do was to choose among these by the aesthetic elegance of the system, because questions of testability were not in the forefront of philosophy. Today they are. And in that kind of situation, Christianity has a remarkable advantage. I use this kind of technique in the Altizer debate. If you read my debate with the Death of God theologian Altizer at the University of Chicago, you'll see that I am doing exactly this sort of thing, in forcing Altizer to the question, how could you even tell in principle whether your position was saying anything meaningful? And he's totally unable to provide any answers along that line. His position turns out to be a personal expression and nothing else, and he has to admit this. But the minute that a person admits that his philosophy of life is only a personal expression, then it is immediately removed from any significance for other people as a meaningful choice. This kind of thing, in other words, can provide the epistemological basis for personal testimony in the case of Christians that doesn't exist for other people at all. Find ourselves in a much different position from the position that we have so often had, the posture that we so often present. We're not any longer lined up along with 82 other religious positions, and each of us is saying, oh, my heart is warmer than your heart, and boy, isn't everything peachy keen in my life. And everybody is shouting this louder than the other person, and the result of it is just a cacophony and a din. We have a situation where, after everybody has finished the shouting, the Christian says, okay, how do we know that in the case of all of you, it isn't stomach trouble? How do we know it isn't stomach trouble for all of you? And there isn't any answer that comes back. And the Christian says, all right, now let's proceed to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because he is living in my heart because he, first of all, objectively rose again from the dead back in the first century. And this is as demonstrable as any other comparable fact of history, and if you want to dump it, the only way you can dump it is at the expense of history and your empirical knowledge of the present, because the very same kind of investigation is pursued in all of these respects. You can see the potential of this. The potential is tremendous. Interestingly enough, in the latest issue of Christianity Today, the one that arrived today, the March 4th issue, there is a book review of a work on Wittgenstein. And so if you'd like to have a very interesting three-column account of Wittgenstein's position, the review could stand a few improvements, but it's very helpful. Then you should go to the March 4th, 1977 issue of Christianity Today, pages 41 through 43. All right, this is one area that it seems to me has tremendous possibilities, apologetically. We go on now to the second area, and I'm going to talk about this more briefly, even though I think it has even more potential than the one I just mentioned. And the reason I'm going to talk about it more briefly is that during the second part of the period, I'm going to read you a paper. You forced me to read a few. I'm going to read you a paper just to show you that you're not the only people who have to write papers. I had to write a paper too, and I'm delivering this at a conference in 2 weeks, and it deals with the subject of the miraculous, which I avoided in our class presentations to this point. And since this contains some advanced work on the subject of miracle that you will not find in anything else, I see no good reason why you can't get a little exposure to it in the last class period. But what is the other area that I think has potential for an apologetic breakthrough? It is Mirabilis Dictu, in the days following Watergate, the area of legal theory, the area of the law. Here is a fascinating book written by an English philosopher who is now teaching in the United States. The book is entitled The Uses of Argument, and the author is Stephen Toulmin. Toulmin was influenced by Wittgenstein, and so there is a kind of connecting link between what I'm going to talk about now and what I was talking about earlier. The book is published by Cambridge University Press, came out a few years ago, and the theme of this book by Toulmin is that philosophers would do themselves a service if they would model their argumentation on legal argument instead of modeling it on deductive, logical-type arguments. That's really the entire point of Toulmin's book. Toulmin says, through the history of philosophy, we have had people using the analytic model in argumentation. They have used sort of the Euclid type of argument from axioms, self-evident first principles, and they have attempted to determine the nature of the world in that fashion. Obviously, this is the source of some of the problems that we were just discussing. This is the source of some of the Hegelian bombast, the notion that you can get a sort of self-evident principle and then you can deduce the nature of things from this. Says Toulmin, this is a sad business, and it's too bad that philosophers have so often fallen into that. He uses Descartes as an example, the French philosopher Descartes, who built his entire system in a deductive fashion in that way. Says Toulmin, it would be better if we looked around in life and tried to find an area where verification, is carried out as a practical human activity, where it becomes necessary to arbitrate truth questions by some kind of technique. And if we were to do that, says Toulmin, we would stop with great appreciation at the doors of the temple of the law. Because in the area of the law, society is constantly faced with questions of truth. It becomes necessary to determine who's right and who's wrong. And often matters of life or death are dependent on exactly that kind of decision. The question is, Did he murder her with an axe, or didn't he? This has to be resolved as a societal question, because you can't have people running around doing that sort of thing. So instead of, as in primitive societies, the relatives of the murdered person going on a vendetta and wiping out the person that they think was responsible, instead you have a kind of liturgical battle which takes place in the courtroom, in which the parties are represented by attorneys, and those attorneys joust with each other, and out of this comes a decision. But it isn't just a kind of jousting. It isn't a non-rational activity. Instead, there are keen standards of evidence that are set up, and these keen standards of evidence make it possible to winnow the question down to keen factual issues, and these factual issues then are decided upon. Says Toulmin, if philosophers modeled their work along that line, they would do a great deal better. You can see how Toulmin has benefited from Wittgenstein's insights in this. What he's saying really is, you can get a better language game for your purposes in the game of the law than you can in the game of geometry or pure mathematics or deductive logic. It seems to me that this argument applies with far greater force in the area of Christian apologetics. I think that the model of legal argument has remarkable potential for apologetics. It seems to me that one of the most serious problems in contemporary apologetics is the fact that most everybody who's doing apologetics, there aren't very many, but those who are doing it tend to be trained in traditional philosophy. The people who do the most effective apologetic work are those who have not been contaminated by a lot of philosophy. C.S. Lewis, for example, who operates out of a background of English literature and history, does immensely better apologetics than people who are strictly operating from traditional philosophy.